Talk Show.
Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you would best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is April 18th, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is joining us for the next installment of Bolshevism in the Iberian Peninsula, the Spanish Civil War. How are you doing today, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. And you said that before we begin with Carr, you wanted to discuss something.
Well, yeah, we should probably lay some foundation for this, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, for last week's program, I had looked all over the. The internet and for various sources that told a balanced or at least a true revisionist story of the Spanish Civil War. And all of the sources I found, practically all of them, are heavily biased in favor of the so-called Republicans, who we know are the communists and their liberal bed partners.
They're just the Bolshevists in Spain.
Well, right. That's what it boils down to. And it's incredible the amount of data there is out there on the internet in support of that side. It's like the whole Jewish side of its history rewritten by the Jews for the benefit of the Jews. There's no doubt. And even some of the better revisionist sources still cave in to the language that the Western liberals have used to describe the Spanish Civil War. In other words, even the better, more scholarly sources will still call the Francoists fascists, even though at the beginning of the war only a small portion of them were fascists, and most of them were Spanish Catholic traditionalists who opposed Bolshevism for Christian and Catholic reasons. And they weren't fascists at all.
Was Franco wasn't even originally in the Falange Party, was it? He joined that later.
Well, yes. During the course of the war, a lot of the traditionalists and conservatives that were Francoists on the Franco side of the battle, they radicalized more or less, and a lot of them began to identify themselves with fascists. And that Barnes Review article that we read last week, that made that pretty clear. But at the beginning of the war, and for the better part of it, they were not. Most of the Francoist side did not identify themselves as fascists. It's the Jewish Western media that has labeled all of these people fascists. And the same media has labeled these Bolsheviks as Republicans. From the 1931 elections, they were all liberals that won those parties that won those elections. They were liberal, there was no doubt. And a good many of them were Bolsheviks, but they weren't all Bolsheviks, yet when the war played out, they all took the side of the Bolsheviks. Just like it happens that we identify the sides in the Spanish Civil War by the extreme wings of either side. But basically the Republicans were all liberals who were led by the Bolsheviks, and the Francoist side was basically, at the beginning of the war, a great majority of it was Catholic traditionalists.
Normal country folk.
Yes, absolutely. And with the property owners who were more Catholic traditionalists and they had the most to lose, but they were only about 4% of the population in the first place. But they lined up with the traditionalists, and so did the fascists. Because fascism is a reaction to the evils of capitalism. And the Jewish capitalists did not attack fascism head on. They only wrote the propaganda concerning fascism. and used the Bolsheviks and the communists, that they used them to attack the fascists head on. And that's why in Nazi Germany, as the fascists rose to power, you didn't see mainstream people attacking the brown shirts or upsetting Hitler's rallies.
The mainstream
all
people
you saw,
were brown shirts, pretty much.
Well, right, exactly. But either that or they were still apathetic. And most of, you know, all of the people that had tried to upset the rallies of their opposition turned out to be Marxists and Bolsheviks.
They were hardcore communists, and many of them were Jews.
Yes, most of them were Jews. And fascism is a reaction to the evils of Jewish capitalism, and the Jewish capitalists used Bolsheviks and Jews to counter fascism. Look at today, what's going on. Today we have an awakening on the extreme right wing. I mean, it's been very slow starting, but it's been going on for 30 years.
Been a long time coming.
And who opposes us but the ARA, the anti-fascists, the Antifa, and the extreme leftist groups propped up by the ADL and the SPLC.
Jewish money power.
Right. They're our only opposition. And you know, when it comes down to it in the street.
Well, they may get a few people that are do-gooders and think that racism is wrong and racial purity is wrong, and they don't really understand that they're locking arms with Bolsheviks that come out to oppose us, but the only people that try and shut down our meetings and attack the elderly people and whatnot, they never go toe-to-toe with the young bucks like myself. They always seem to be ARA and Jews.
Well, right. That's the way it is. The ADL uses the capitalists use the ADL, and the ADL uses the radical left to counter any opposition. And when they can't do it through their media propaganda and their official statements that they pass to the government, that they do it using the anti-FA and groups like that. And those groups may as well actually be organizations, official vehicles of the ADL, because the ADL funds them. But
the
ADL gets away
ADL.
With... You see, the ADL itself cannot take to the streets and start smashing cars.
No.
So they support and finance these Antifa groups and these extremist college groups, and they have these drunken idiot kids go do it for them.
Absolutely, yes.
And that way they keep their noses clean. But they know what they're doing.
And I think at some point we're going to need a movement, a brown shirt style movement, to protect our meeting places.
Well, that might be. I mean, that it might come down to that someday, but that's what Richard Butler tried to do, and you see where that got him, right?
Yeah, I guarantee you, though, if we had 20 or 30 brown shirts in Binghamton, they wouldn't have shown up at that meeting hall.
Well, right, but we couldn't even get two pole bashers there, so. Okay, William Guy Carr. Yeah, you know, Clifton, so anyway, my point is that I looked all over and I could only find leftist propaganda. I didn't find any, except for that Barnes Review article that we covered last week, I couldn't find anything that was either balanced or favored the revisionist positions, that the conservative, traditionalist revisionist positions to discuss the Spanish Civil War. And I was having a conversation with Clifton, and Clifton actually said, well, what about William Guy Carr? And to be honest, I haven't read William Guy Carr. And Clifton, you know, he esteems this very highly, and this you know, a lot of us came into the Christian identity truth through the conspiratorialist historians, and that was Clifton's route, and he esteems William Guy Carr very much. And when I looked at it, he has five excellent chapters on the Spanish Civil War, which he calls the Spanish Revolution, which is a better name for it. And these chapters, they astonishingly, I mean, I shouldn't be astonished, but it's, you know, when something agrees with what you've been saying so well and you haven't read it or used it as a source yet, it's very edifying. Well, I glanced over these five chapters we're about to cover, and that's the feeling that I got. So I think that it's an excellent – and even though I prefer documentary sources, in this case, they're few and far between, and William Guy Carr is the best place to turn to, and he's practically a documentary source because he actually lived through these things and observed a lot of them firsthand. He was in the Navy. He had a long naval career. And I'd like to read the little piece in Pawns of the Game, the About the Author piece,
well,
first.
You're basically saying, though, that we're not going to find a Russia number one equivalent on the Spanish situation.
Well, no, we're not. No, we're not. And if there might be, you know, Russia number one equivalents on the Spanish civilization stuffed into the drawers of MI5 in Britain somewhere or the, you know, the CIA offices.
We're not getting it.
Well, we're not getting it. No, it's buried. And that's just the way it is. I don't find it. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm only one person, but and somebody else may have better luck researching it, but I can't find it. And I'm sure Gerald Moseley probably got some stuff in his library stashed that he ain't shown us yet either. But I'm just kidding, Gerald. Well, anyway, about the author, William Guy Carr, Pawns in the Game. At the early age of 12, the author was thoroughly indoctrinated into the Bolshevik ideology by two revolutionary missionaries who traveled on the same ship with him out to the Orient in 1907. Unlike many others, he didn't swallow the bait they offered him hook, line, and sinker. He decided to keep an open mind and to investigate matters thoroughly before reaching any conclusions. His investigations and studies of all angles of the international conspiracy have taken him to nearly every country in the world. Commander Carr has had a distinguished naval career. During World War I, he served as navigating officer of HM submarines. In World War II, he was naval control officer for the St. Lawrence, then staff officer operations at Shelburne, Nova Scotia, the senior naval officer at Goose Bay, Labrador. As an officer on the staff of the Commodore Reginald Brock, he organized the 7th Victory Loan for the 22 Royal Canadian Naval Training Divisions. As an author, he has previously published the 7 books listed above. Some were specially bound for inclusion in the Royal Library, the Library of the Imperial War Museum, and the Sir Millington Drake Library, which is bequeathed to Eton College, and the Braille Library for the Blind. Several of his books have been published in European languages. The books are By Guess and By God, Hell's Angels of the Deep, High and Dry, Good Hunting, Out in the Mists, Checkmate in the North, and Brass Hats and Bell-Bottom Trousers. So they're mostly naval-related. Commander Carr is known to many Canadians who have attended his public lectures. He toured Canada for the Canadian clubs in 1930 and 31. And 31 was the year of the election that brought the Liberals and the Bolsheviks tied in with them to power in Spain. He warned people of the existence of an international conspiracy. He foretold that the conspirators would, unless checked, drag the world into another global war. In the years between 1931 and 1939, he addressed the social and service clubs all over Ontario. In 1944 and 1945, he was sent on another lecture tour of Canada by the naval authorities. He explained why it would be necessary to win the peace if the fruits of military victory were not to be thrown away again. Speaking of World War I, World War II, I'm sorry, 1944 and 45. Commander Carr is determined to inform as many people as possible regarding the evil forces which adversely affect all of our lives and the lives of our children. His book will be an eye-opener to parents, clergymen, teachers, students, statesmen, politicians, and labor leaders. Pawns in the Game. Here is a true story of international intrigue, romances, corruption, graft, and political assassinations, the likes of which has never been written before. It is a story of how different groups or atheistic material men had played in an international chess tournament to decide which group would win ultimate control of the wealth, natural resources, and manpower of the entire world. It is explained how the game has reached the final stage, the international communists and the international capitalists, both of whom have totalitarian ambitions, have temporarily joined hands to defeat Christian democracy.
Well, can I interject right here? I just want to say that these are not his thoughts, right? Right here, this is somebody writing
about...
Oh, right,
this is the publisher.
Obviously, the publisher is not going to say that international capitalism, finance, international communism, they're both in the hands of the Jew.
Well, the publisher may not even know that. He may not even understand that international communism was only set up by international capitalists to drive us into their arms and to control us further. The cover design shows that all moves made by the international conspirators are directed by Satan, and he's talking about the cover design of the book, right? There's a drawing on the front of the book. And while the situation is decidedly serious, it is definitely not hopeless. And it's very interesting to see that they connect Satan to the international communists and the international capitalists. It's almost like the book, like the publisher was a two-seed line preacher or something. The solution is an end game that the international conspirators have been playing right now before one or another totalitarian-minded group impose their ideas on the rest of mankind. The story is sensational and shocking, but it is educational because it is the truth. The author offers practical solutions to problems so many people consider insoluble. And that's about William Guy Carr.
And I'm just reading from his introduction. He quotes Revelation 2:9, Revelation 3:9, and John 8:44, and he says that the people who call themselves Jews or Israelites are liars. He refers to them as the synagogue of Satan and the house of Rothschild. I'd say he knows something about dual seed line then, wouldn't you?
Well, right, and I'm sure a lot of intelligent men have expressed it, you know, and discovered this over the years, because, I mean, we claim to have it from the Bible and documentary sources, and if we could see it, then others can see it. Yeah, you know, it's not a truth that's peculiar to two seed line or Wesley Swift or and any, you know, Bill Gale or any of those people. It's simply a truth.
Well, I mean, Wesley Swift didn't just wake up in 1960 and say, "Oh, dual seed line. No one's ever seen this, but I see it now."
Well, right. It all came from somewhere. There's nothing new under the sun, and many other men saw it before Wesley Swift. That they may not have.
They weren't as publicized.
Well, they may not have written about it to the length that he did. You want to read anything else from the introduction or start chapter 12?
Can we jump right into chapter 12? You want
to
begin or shall I?
Nah, be my guest.
The long-range plan for the ultimate subjugation of Spain started, as in other countries, soon after the death of Christ. In an attempt to crush the power of the Christian church in Spain, the moneylenders, their agents to infiltrate into the congregations and pose as Christians. This placed them in positions to destroy the church organizations from within. This conspiracy became obvious, and in the 13th century, Pope Innocent III instituted the Inquisition. The purpose of the Inquisition was to ferret out and question infidels suspected of masquerading as Christians. And haven't the Jews always done that when they're compelled to convert? They just convert and they continue going about their murderous, thieving ways.
Well, absolutely. That's something. I mean, look at the...
That's right out of the protocols. If you must convert, then do so, because you can do nothing else.
That's what they do. That they convert facetiously and they keep their religion under their cloak. And then they use their conversion to spoil the flock. You can't turn a wolf into a sheep. It doesn't work. Christ warned us about that. And the medieval church should have known better.
Spain had been exceptionally kind to the Jews. They were allowed to hold office and acted as tax collectors. That's no shock.
Even though they brought the Moors into the Jews, it's well known. Maurice Pinier, the plot against the church. The Jews brought the Moors into Gothic Spain in their attempt to destroy it in the 7th century.
They threw open the gates of the city of Granada, the strategically important city in southern Spain. They helped the Moors take that city, and that opened the way for the Moors to take all the rest of Spain.
No doubt, and almost take France. And now today they have it. That's just incredible. All right, go on.
But as happened in every other country in Europe, the crimes of the atheistic moneylenders and their agents were charged against the whole Jewish population. Between 1475 and 1504, during the reign of Isabella and Ferdinand, the Inquisition was used extensively to locate and destroy all traitors who plotted to overthrow the power of the church and state. The Inquisitors, under Torquemada, discovered the subversive underground to be so widespread and well-organized that in 1492, Spain followed the example of other European countries and expelled all the Jews. And that's why Columbus set sail. He was looking for a homeland for his people. It's no coincidence that he set sail in 1492. This task provided the opportunity for some extremists to organize mob violence against the Jews, and several extensive and regrettable massacres took place. I'd say the only thing regrettable is that they weren't all-encompassing. These illegal killings were condemned publicly by the church authorities in Rome. After the international bankers reorganized during the 1600s, their agents infiltrated into the Spanish Treasury Department. They were exceptionally active during both the English and French revolutions, trying to destroy the Spanish economy in order to prepare the way for revolutionary efforts in that country also. And Spain was exceptionally weak at this point in time. Wouldn't you say that when the Jews came back into Spain, the Spanish Empire crumbled soon after? That Spain enjoyed an almost golden age from the time they expelled the Jews to about maybe 200 years later.
The Jews are like termites. They suck all the substance out of a 4x4, and eventually it can't bear its load anymore. It just caves in.
You have to constantly maintain vigilance because they will worm their way back in, won't they?
Yes, they will.
It is worthwhile to study the political intrigue that went on in Spain from 1839 to 1939 because it gives a clear picture of the pattern of the ultimate subjugation of all countries. There are three steps in all revolutionary efforts. One, infiltration by the agents of the Revolutionary Party into the government, civil services, armed forces, and labor organizations in order to be in position to destroy the government from within when the order to revolt is given. And that's already been accomplished in this nation.
Yes, it has. Fully.
The affiliation of the Revolutionary Party with the Socialist or Liberal Party left of center in order to overthrow the established government regardless of whether it is a monarchy or a republic. That's already been accomplished in this country.
Well, here they have the right of center too, though, so we don't need to be overthrown.
Exactly. Three, subversive actions to bring about anarchy in order to discredit the Popular Front government and provide the excuse for forming a proletarian dictatorship. Once this is established, purges turn it into a totalitarian dictatorship as it happened in Russia in 1917. And we're basically, this is an ongoing process in this country. Wouldn't you say that they always have some sort of WTO anarchist riot? They have Antifa and ARA taking to the streets, as we discussed earlier. They're always trying to destabilize this country and push us into a crisis.
Well, right, and that's why so many right-wing type people in this country have long been expecting us to also become a totalitarian dictatorship. But as long as the Jew gets his way, as long as they get their way, that won't happen, except very slowly and painfully.
Well, they've gotten their way peacefully, so why would they want to have blood in the streets? Because a lot of that blood would be their blood.
Absolutely.
Karl Marx's agents organized Spain's first general political strike in 1865. In 1868, the directors of the World Revolutionary Movement, WRM, sent Signor Fanelli to Spain, to affiliate the anarchists with the Marxist revolutionaries. And interestingly enough, the anarchists were later purged in Spain when they were no longer needed. The communists got rid of them. There was basically a civil war within the civil war. And the anarchists were purged in the Bolshevik Revolution as well. Fanelli was what were you saying?
Useful idiots.
Well, they sided with the communists under the pretense of personal liberty and maximum freedom, the ability to do whatever they wanted, and they wound up being used just as tools to overthrow the existing order, and then they were gotten rid of since the communists had no intention of maximizing personal liberty.
That happens all the time. I mean, that we see that in a microcosm here every election.
Absolutely. Fanelli was a close friend of Bakunin, who was a close associate of Marx and Engels. In 1870, Bakunin fell out with Marx over policy. He was expelled from the First International of the WRM. In 1872, Bakunin influenced the Spanish revolutionary leaders into forming the Socialist Democratic Alliance. The Spanish government decreed Bakunin's extremist organizations illegal, but they continued to exist underground. That's because the people continued to exist underground. You can outlaw the organization, but if you don't round up the leadership and get rid of them, the organization still effectively exists.
Well, what we don't understand is that Satan doesn't care about laws.
Exactly.
As long as he has money, that's all he needs.
The Grand Orient Lodges formed convenient headquarters. Wait, the Grand Orient Lodges. That's Masonic.
The Masonic Lodges of France.
They were meeting in Masonic temples.
Yes. Well, of course they were.
That's where the French Revolution was planned, in the Masonic Lodges.
And it was the Grand Orient Lodge that the French Revolution came out of.
At a conference held in Zaragoza, the Spanish section of the Marxist International agreed to ally themselves with the Anarchist International. After its affiliation, both groups concentrated in organizing the various labor groups into a vast Carnora. They crowned their combined efforts with a revolution which produced the first Spanish Republic in 1873. And I'm sure this was just a sham republic a la 1917 Russia under Kerensky, a weak provisional government that they're eventually going to destroy. The effort on the part of the revolutionary leaders was accomplished with the usual reign of terror. Anarchy ran wild. All kinds of excesses took place. Finally, General Pavia brought off a coup d'etat, and the revolutionaries went underground again. And if he hadn't done that, they would have consolidated that anarchistic republic into a proletarian dictatorship.
Absolutely. 40 years before the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia.
In order to emerge into the open once more, the members of the revolutionary underground supported the leaders of a mild so-called liberal movement to obtain political power.
And that's how they do it all the time. And that's what they did to the Democratic Party here.
That's what they've done in all the parliamentarian democracies in Western Europe, Britain and France. They basically voted socialism in.
If you look at the Democratic Party down south until recently, but nationally, up until the time of Woodrow Wilson, the Democratic Party was basically
the white man's party.
The white man's party. It was the party of the right. And the liberal Republican Party was the party of the rich that had always tried to leverage the poor and downtrodden against the middle, against the white man. But Wilson and Roosevelt changed the politics of the Democratic, Bolshevized basically the politics of the Democratic Party.
They pushed out all the real conservatives, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. And many conservatives finally fled to the Republican Party, but that's still been the party of the rich. It's still the party of globalism. Even the great conservative Ronald Reagan, and I say that very sarcastically, because he did more damage than most Republican presidents. Well, he was a globalist. There's nothing conservative about globalism. Globalism is international Bolshevism. It's the submission to international capital and international Bolshevism. That's what globalism is.
So he goes to Berlin and tells, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Well, he leaves our border wide open and 10 million Mexicans come in here and he gives them all amnesty.
Well, yes, we had a huge amnesty of Mexicans under Reagan. And that was supposed to be the amnesty to end all amnesty.
Well, we've seen how that goes.
Well, yeah, now it's 10 times worse.
Somebody should have said to him, Mr. Reagan, build a wall.
Well, he was playing the whore for the international corporations and the Jews on Wall Street. And at the same time, being an actor, he sounded like a great conservative doing it. He didn't conserve a damn thing.
My dad basically said that Reagan was a fraud and that he
was a fraud. He was an actor. They picked the right guy for the job.
Well, they called him the great communicator. And I once said that it seemed like he could hand you a crap sandwich and tell you it was a tasty grilled chicken sandwich and get you to eat it.
Yes, he could. And he was a lovable guy, and a lot of people are still attached to him. He was a fraud, and he did all the work of the international Jew and the international Bolsheviks. That's exactly what he did. He was there for.
I'd say he's on par with FDR in terms of Bolshevizing the country.
Well, look at Nixon, too. The great conservative Richard Nixon, he opened China. We have him to thank for the position we're in right now. He opened the spigots and let cheap Chinese goods just pour into this country.
I think Nixon genuinely wanted to do something about Jewry, but he knew how powerful they were, and that's why they ruined him, because they knew that he was getting ready to rise up against them.
Well, he played their whore. He went and prostrated himself before the Mongol king, and look at what the shape we're in now.
All right. The revolutionary leaders used a quarrel going on between those who claimed to be the descendants of Don Carlos. Should occupy the throne and those who claimed the descendants of Isabella should reign to start a civil war. This war ended with the defeat of the Carlist group in 1876. And as we pointed out last week, the Carlists formed a large part of the original Falange foot soldiers. They were just traditional monarchists. The Spanish workers really desired to organize for their own protection, but the majority did not agree with the extreme policy advocated by the anarchists. And as I've often pointed out, that most workers just want their basic human rights and dignity, and they want to work an honest job for an honest pay. They don't want to run around with free love communes and go naked and attack people on the streets for having a three-piece suit, do they?
Right.
That's why the Jews always have trouble getting people on board with these radical anarchist movements, since most workers don't want to cut the factory owner's throat, rape his daughter, and take over the factory and communally run it. They just want their rights. They want decent breaks, decent safe conditions, and they want decent pay for their decent work. The anti-revolutionaries therefore organized the Workers' Association. These moderates were immediately set upon by both revolutionaries and employers of labor alike. Their persecution continued until 1888, when at the suggestion of Pablo Iglesias, the moderate group adopted the name the Workers' General Union, which became known in Spain as the UGT. The members of this organization did not get much support until after the government outlawed the Iberian Anarchist Federation. The syndicalist elements collaborated with the Radical Republican Party until 1908. They then formed the Solidaridad Obrera, and 2 years later, in 1910, they rounded the Regional Federation of Labor known in Spain as the CRT. Immediately afterwards, they formed the National Federation of Labor, CNT. In 1913, both the CRT and CNT were suspended as a result of a series of strikes. The government did not object to the principles of collective bargaining, but it did object to the extremist policy and revolutionary actions of the leaders. So legitimate labor, striving for social justice, found their organizations barred because the radical element always seemed able to work its way into executive positions within the unions. And around this time in the United States, when you say that most unions, the rank-and-file members were not leftists, but the leadership were typically Jewish Bolshevists and socialists?
All the time. And I experienced that personally. I was consistently complaining about my union dues going to liberal causes. And they did. They collected their union dues from the rank-and-file, and the rank-and-file, most of them didn't care what the unions did with their union dues, and the unions would pour those due dollars and dues dollars of their members into backing liberal and basically Bolshevik causes. There's no doubt. And look at the NRA. The NRA is the perfect example of that in this country. The National Education Association.
Okay.
And most teachers, there's a lot of liberal teachers, but not all teachers are liberal. And
most teachers aren't communists.
Well, right. Most teachers are not communists. But all of their dues dollars goes into supporting Bolshevik causes in this country, time and year in and year out.
I had one teacher in high school. He had a Soviet hammer and sickle flag in his room, and he had the American flag upside down.
Yeah, well, I think I probably would have told him something, make me fail.
And I'm wondering, you know, I asked him, why do you have that Soviet flag? And he said, oh, we did a unit on the Soviet Union. And I said, well, isn't the unit over then? And I wonder what would have happened if I were a history teacher and we did a unit on National Socialist Germany. So I took out the old National Socialist flag.
Well, it was it was November 1995, and I thought I was a conservative Republican at the time. And my stepson brought home all kinds of literature from the Democratic Party at presidential election. A few days later, it was parent teacher's night, and I berated his teacher for not because he brought home no Republican literature. And she said, well, I couldn't get any. And I told her, well, then you should have given him nothing. I told her she was trying to program my kids to be little commies, and she didn't like that one bit. But I practically had her in tears, but I didn't care.
All right, you want to take over, or shall I continue?
It's blatantly, you know, the radicals and the Bolsheviks have always been blatantly biased, and the Jewish media just destroys, or attempts to destroy anybody biased, in favor of
morality,
of constitutional conservatism or racial conservatism. You'll get trounced by the media.
And they howl for equal time and equal access when they're in the minority, but when they control all the instruments of mass dissemination of information, such as the media and the college institutions, we suddenly no longer hear about equal time. Now we hear about hate speech control regulations.
Right. And there is no real white right-wing media, and there never has been. And
no.
And there's a lot of turkeys that look at Fox News as right-wing media, and they're just deceiving themselves.
That's just acceptable so-called conservatism that the Jews don't really mind, since it's not going to lead anywhere. It's not racially oriented.
Well, right. They set up, you know, one of those companies is set up just to make it look like there's a right-wing media, but Fox News isn't right-wing, not one bit. Where are you? I lost my spot. I'm sorry.
All right. Shall I continue then?
Yes.
The reaction was what the plotters of World Revolution expected it would be. The revolutionary syndicalist movement greatly increased in power and acted against all political parties and against the state itself. The policy of these extremists was direct action, advocated with the greatest heat and violence. In 1916, the CRT was reorganized by Angel Pestana and Salvador Seguí. In 1918, these two labor leaders were able to form in Barcelona the Sol Syndicate, generally known as the Big One Syndicate, the One Big Syndicate. During World War I, Spain, as a neutral country, made a vast amount of money, but, generally speaking, the laboring classes did not receive anything like a fair share of the national prosperity. And I'm sure they made all that money by selling weapons to both sides in typical Jewish fashion.
Yeah, probably.
This fact was perhaps the deciding factor which drove the majority of the working classes out of moderate labor organizations into the arms of the revolutionary leaders and the extremist labor groups. However, the more moderate and level-headed labor leaders didn't give up the fight against the radical groups, and as a result of their efforts, they brought into being a new labor group known as the Free Syndicate in 1920. During the next 3 years, there was continuous strife going on between the right and left labor organizations. Local strikes, general strikes, destruction of property, private assassinations to remove labor leaders, wholesale murders to reduce the strength of opposing organizations. All these crimes were committed in the name of liberty. By 1923, conditions became chaotic. To prevent the Communist Party bringing about another revolution, the King of Spain asked General Franco to become military dictator. One of the first results of Primo de Rivera's dictatorship was the successful termination of the Moroccan War. It was during the final stages of this war that General General Franco greatly distinguished himself in the field. He turned what looked like a complete military defeat into a brilliant victory. By tempering justice with mercy, he won the admiration and loyalty of many of the Moroccan natives. It was thus he came to the notice of the general public in Spain. Rivera is accused by his enemies of doing everything a man shouldn't do. It is only fair to record that he did restore law and order. He brought about a number of social reforms. He cooperated with Largo Caballero to improve working conditions. He worked so hard that only his breakdown in health in 1929 can explain the errors in judgment he made in 1930. Tired and worn out, and as if in a hurry to unburden himself of the responsibilities of office, he called in two socialist leaders, Basterio and Sabaret. He charged them with the task of reorganizing the electoral machinery of the nation so the people could decide whether they wanted a monarchy or a republican government. Just why de Rivera appointed Basterio and Saboret to reorganize the electoral machine of Spain will probably never be known.
Well, right, and I would say that that's probably why the Republicans won in 1931, why the liberal parties won, right?
All right, you want to take over?
And they're misnamed Republicans, and I probably shouldn't propagate that. The two socialists rigged the election machinery so well that a socialist Republican government was assured. In Madrid alone, the number of fictitious voters exceeded 40,000. Sounds like Chicago.
We see this every election. I read that something like 40,000 dead people voted in New Jersey in the last election. And in the one before that, we had 10,000 dead people in Ohio. And in one town in Ohio, the town had a population of 600. They found 3,500 votes were cast.
There's no doubt. Some Negroes in some districts in New Jersey vote over and over again.
Stalin said that voters never decide elections. Those who count the votes decide the elections.
That's probably true also. And that's where states have totally abdicated their responsibility. The two socialists rigged the election machinery so well that a socialist Republican government was assured. In Madrid alone, the number of fictitious voters exceeded 40,000. Similar corruption existed in all the larger centers of population. So we see that the liberals in the media and the liberal school texts and the books I found, they try to portray that a Republican government was fairly voted in 1931, and in 1936, these evil right-wing fascists rose up against it and destroyed it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I've always heard, that the socialists had a mandate to rule from the masses, and that evil fascists who refused to accept the democratic process simply rose in rebellion against the socialists.
And here we see that Bolsheviks infiltrated their way in and fixed all this up. And
they cooked the elections.
And now they're upset that it was that the right wing, the conservative people of the nation, put a stop to it. And it's a damn shame they don't do it here.
Basically,
if we only realized that the same thing was going on here, maybe people would wake up. But it's not possible because the media is too controlled here.
It's like somebody deceiving or defrauding your mother or grandmother, and you go across town, bop them over the head, and take back the money they swindled. And then they cry foul as though somehow you've stolen from them when you're just taking back what they stole.
Exactly, and that's exactly what happened in Germany during the Weimar years. The whole nation was stolen from the German people. And under Hitler, the German people got it back, and then the Jews cried foul. Yeah, only Jews are allowed to steal, and their religion teaches them that. The Talmud teaches them that. The Talmud teaches them that they're entitled to the property of all non-Jews. And they, in their minds, they honestly believe that. And that's why they cry foul when we take something from them. But it's never a problem when they take something from us.
And that's why they wrote the Communist Manifesto, which teaches that the goyim have no private property rights, or the bourgeois, but it's the same thing.
Well, communism is only it is the political expression of Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
The Communist Manifesto is the political expression of the Talmud.
And I think bourgeois is just a synonym for goyim.
Well, absolutely it is. There's no doubt. There's no doubt. They'll tell the working classes that the bourgeois are those rich people over there. But as soon as they get into control, that bourgeois balloons into a whole different thing.
Everyone who's not a Jew is now bourgeois.
Well, practically, that's what it boils down to. To ensure the end of the monarchy in Spain, the Grand Orient Lodges organized a special military brotherly union. Whenever you hear fraternity, egality, and liberty, know that the Jews are talking. Whenever you hear universal brotherhood and freedom, know that those words are coming out of the mouth of Satan to deceive Eve and Adams alike. All right. A military brotherly union by which they obtained the promise of 21 of the 23 Spanish generals to support the Republican cause. General Mola, who was chief of Spanish internal security, in his book Tempestad Calma, Integra y Crisis, informs us that the generals were initiated into the Grand Orient Lodge and had 1.5 million pesetas placed to their credit to help them escape abroad should Republican movement fail. Franco was one of the two generals who refused to join the military brotherly union. So we see that Franco was one of 4% of the generals of Spain who was not a traitor. That's incredible. In support of Mola's statement, Cano López said on the floor of the Spanish Cortes, the parliament, since 1925, Masonry is grouped under the heading Military Brotherly Union. Most of the high-ranking officials of the army. The members include the Cabanellas, San Giorgio, Godet, Mola, López, Ochoa, Quiapo de Llana, and others. Of 23 divisional generals, 21 were Masons. All had taken the oath of the Grand Orient, which is, I swear obedience without limitation to the head of the Council of 23. I swear to acknowledge no mortal as above him.
And that's probably Satan or Satan's minion.
I'm sure it's some Rothschild appointee, that's for sure. López added, both in 1929 for the abolition of the dictatorship of De Rivera and in 1931 for the abolition of the monarchy, the Grand Orient issued the orders most of the other generals obeyed. There we have it. General Mola tells how he and most of the other generals broke their oath to the Grand Orient when they became convinced that they were being used to further the secret plans of Stalin to turn Spain into another communist dictatorship. And let me state that we're not getting into it, but William Guy Carr actually footnotes all of this. And this book is available on Clifton Emmerhage's site and on the Mein Kampf project at Christigenia. The international bankers helped finance the revolutionary effort in Spain without becoming involved themselves. Well, no surprise. In February 1932, Le Journal reports that Stalin promised $200,000 to help finance the revolutionary training schools in Spain. The financial settlement submitted to the 1931 Congress of the Communist International discloses the fact that £240,000 of English money, I wonder who had that, had been received to help the Spanish revolutionaries. In addition to the above, 2.5 million pesetas were made available for the purchase of arms and ammunition. General Mola says that by 1938, over 200 revolutionary leaders had arrived in Spain after being trained in the Lenin Institute in Moscow.
And I'm sure they were, what percentage of those were Jews?
Oh, I would say probably 199 of them. From 1930, and one gypsy. From 1930 to the date of the election a campaign of L'Infamie had been carried out against the King of Spain and the royal family. In other words, a perjured, you know, a campaign of slander. Hmm. And the King of Spain and the royal family, exactly as it was against Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. One of the most ridiculous lies ever invented, claimed that one Spanish soldier was bled to death every day to keep the Prince of Asturias alive. He was known to be suffering from hemophilia. Other slanders accused the king of being a libertine, just as the Empress of Russia had falsely been accused of being a mistress to Rasputin.
And these accusations come from people that advocate free love.
Well, right. They only come from Jews. All these accusations, they always come from Jews. The plugged ballots in the large industrial centers wiped out the strong rural vote in favor of the monarchy. After the election had been declared to favor a Republican form of government, King Alfonso XIII of Spain issued his last public proclamation. It read as follows. At least they didn't take him out and shoot him. The elections held on Sunday proved to me that I no longer hold the love and affection of my people. What a sucker. My conscience tells me this condition will not be permanent because I have always striven to serve Spain and my people with all my devotion. A king may make mistakes. Without doubt, I have done so on occasion. But I know our country has always shown herself generous towards the faults of others committed without malice. I am the king of all Spaniards, and I am a Spaniard. I could find ample means to maintain my royal prerogatives in effective resistance to those who assail them. But I prefer to stand resolutely aside rather than provoke a conflict which might array my countrymen against one another in civil war and patricidal strife. I renounce no single one of my rights which, rather than being mine, are accumulated in legacy of history for the guardianship of which I shall one day have to render strict account. I shall wait the true and full expression of the collective conscience, and until the nation speaks, I deliberately suspend the exercise of my royal powers and am leaving Spain, thus acknowledging that she is sole mistress of her destinies. Also, now I believe that I am fulfilling the duty which the love of my country dictates. I pray God that all other Spaniards may feel and fulfill their duty as sincerely as I do. Many of the socialists who formed the Spanish Republican government in 1931 were sincere in their beliefs. They wanted no part of red communism or black Nazism, but they were proved to be powerless to prevent the communists and anarchists from putting the second part of the revolutionary program into effect. The tactics the revolutionary leaders employed were to double-cross the socialists at every opportunity. And that's what they do here, too. That they just do it a lot more subtly. The red cells within, the Blue Dog Democrats that go along with the rest of the party because they feel they have to. Red cells within the government caused the government to commit some foolish mistakes. The Reds outside then damned the government as a lot of incompetent, corrupt, and inefficient nincompoops. The communists, the anarchists, claimed only a dictatorship of the proletariat could establish a stable government. There we have it. The agents of Moscow committed every conceivable kind of crime to bring those responsible for internal security into disrepute also. General de Rivera had used Largo Caballero a great deal to iron out differences between labor and employers during the years he had been a dictator. With the advent of the Republican movement, Largo Caballero showed his true colors. By 1935, Caballero openly boasted that he had placed tens of thousands of communist cells throughout Spain. At the 11th plenum of the executive of the Communist International, the Spanish delegates were showered with congratulations because the prerequisites of a revolutionary crisis are being created at a rapid rate in Spain. At the 12th plenum, the wording of the congratulations to the Spanish delegates was as follows, quote, "In Spain in particular, we have been able to observe such revolutionary strike struggles going on uninterruptedly over a period of many months as the Spanish proletariat has never experienced before. What is happening in these struggles is, above all, the further development of a Spanish revolution." There is an old saying, when thieves disagree, the truth will come out. That is exactly what happened in Spain. The three leaders of Moscow's underground in Spain were Joaquín Marín, Víctor Serges, and Andrés Nin. They were all young men. They had all received special training in revolutionary activities at Lenin Institute in Moscow before being entrusted with leadership in Spain. Marín had been mixed up in the separatist movement in Catalonia since he was 16 years of age. At the mature age of 17, this intellectual thinker, in italics, had set out to teach the Spanish people the Soviet solution of the world's economic troubles. We've seen what they are.
I'd like to say Victor Sergei's real name. He was born Victor Levovich Kibalich.
Well, that's more like it. At the age of 21, he was elected head of the anarchists. He preached and practiced the religion of hate and violence. That's Judaism, isn't it? In 1914, he was condemned to 20 years imprisonment, but he was not of legal age for such a penalty. Some Jew lawyer got him off, in other words. Marín was a delegate to the Third Congress of the Communist International held in Moscow, 1921. He attracted favorable attention. With the fall of Primo de Rivera, Marín returned to Spain. He had been hiding out in France and Moscow. He had lived a hectic life. He had been in and out of jail, had escaped from prison, been wounded in 1925, confined in Citadel Montjuich, M-O-N-T-J-U-I-C-H. I'm sorry, I'm destroying that word. It is said the only period of peace he enjoyed in his life was the 3 years he and his young wife, probably a blonde, spent in Paris, 1927 and 1930. Marín wrote a book in 1936. Victor Serges, what's his real name again?
Victor Serges was born Victor Levovich Kibalkich.
Levovich, he's definitely a Jew. There's no doubt he's a Jew. Victor Serges wrote the preface to it. In his book, Hacia la Segunda Revolución, I think that's like, where is the second revolution, or this is the second revolution. My Spanish is really rusty.
Hacia la Segunda Revolución. Hacia, I think, means house. House of the Second Revolution.
No, Hacia is not house.
Sure?
He exposed the fact that Stalin had departed from the Marxian ideology and charged he was using the forces of communism to forward his own secret totalitarian imperialistic ambitions. I don't think Hacia is house. Casa is house.
Yeah.
Even after Marín, Serges, and Nin, and I think Hacia is a verb, even after Marín, Serges, and Nin spoke openly with Stalin in 1936, their power and influence amongst the working classes was so great that Stalin ordered that they should be allowed to live until they had served their purpose. Stalin used them right up to the beginning of the Civil War in Spain. Then he ordered them liquidated. He directed that their death shall be accomplished in such a manner as to make it appear to the public that all three had died as martyrs to the communist cause.
Oh, and Hacia, that means towards the Second Revolution. He was advocating a move towards the Second Revolution by saying that Stalin had basically betrayed the revolution. He was a Trotskyist.
Well, here we have Stalin had them ordered them liquidated. That's Satan's house is always divided against itself.
That's what I said to my dad earlier. Satan's kingdom is divided against itself, and because of that, it won't stand.
All the time. Maureen was betrayed to Franco's forces, and after trial was executed. Sergez is reported to have been shot by loyalists while fighting, and Nin was also disposed of. Now, they were the official accounts of their death, right? Their deaths were loudly attributed to acts of violence by the enemies of communism. Victor Sergez wrote, "The evolution of Soviet communism was completed in 1936. From revolutionary internationalism to a nationalism of great military power served in various countries by parties which it subsidized. After July 1936, the Stalinites formed a unified socialist party affiliated with the Third International. And the object of Stalinism is to establish the new power of a fascist nature to encircle France, the probable ally of Russia, in the war that is being prepared." There we have it, 1936. Then again, Maureen says, and the U.S. and England sided with who? The communists? That is the darkest hour of Anglo-Saxon history. That has to be the worst hour of our history as a people. That we sided with the communists against our brother Germans. That is
the so-called greatest generation. And I saw veterans today collecting money for the greatest generation. I almost wanted to say, well, you serve the Jews. Ask your Jewish masters for money.
Absolutely.
You know, why should I thank you for making the world safe for communism and for Stalin?
That's exactly what they did, and destroyed half of the Saxon race in Europe.
And they basically assured that we would wind up where we are today. They came back to America, moved out to the suburbs, and lived in their nice lily-white neighborhoods while their daughters went to college and were brainwashed to go to bed with blacks.
That's what happened, isn't it?
I think that's their payback for killing their brothers in Europe. They now have mulatto grandchildren, little Obamas running around.
Well, right. They made themselves Satan's whores, and they made their grandchildren Satan's whores, and more literally. Then again, Maureen says, "The traditional policy of England is to ruin its adversaries, so as then to pose as the protector and to render impossible the renaissance of the conquered vassal. Spain is primarily the victim of England and, next in order, of France. When Spain hesitates, England and France attacks her strongly. If she inclines towards England, France increases the persecution. So long as France and England are capitalistic countries, they will not have to be the natural ally to Spain. The logical line would be to curve through Portugal, Germany, Italy, and Russia. A block of this nature would neutralize France and England." Sergez explained how so much loyalist propaganda found its way into the universalist press, While so little space was given to Franco's releases, Sergez wrote, "Never has there been brought into play, the one against the other, such low and demoralizing methods as those used by Stalin and his instrument, the Third International, in a continuous stream of propaganda at long range and without heed for the truth." Sounds like the American newspapers for the last 60 years, 80 years, maybe longer. "The method of repetition and cynicism had become almost mechanical. The Soviet bureaucracy is plotting this procedure on an international scale." Well, they bragged about it. It was open. It's no secret.
Well, how many?
We just never believed it.
Can you show me any speeches where Hitler actually said we're going to take over the world?
Never happened. Only.
But I'm always hearing the History Channel saying that Hitler's attitude was today we rule Germany, tomorrow the world. But I've never seen him give a speech where he said that. And I can actually see speeches where the communists are saying we're going to spread the revolution across the world, and that's why Lenin and Trotsky thought nothing of giving half of the Ukraine at the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk over to Germany, since they said that the revolution would soon spread and there would be no borders and they'd have everything back anyway.
Right. They knew they were going to overthrow Germany, or they believed they were. No doubt. "The method of repetition and cynicism had become almost mechanical. The Soviet bureaucracy is plotting this procedure on an international scale. Every infamy given out by a correspondent of Izvestia at Valentia is at once taken up in a chorus by the special papers in Paris, Stockholm, Oslo, Brussels, London, and New York, Melbourne, and Buenos Aires. Our newspapers are our biggest enemy, and they have been since the Federal Reserve in and probably since the 1890s. Millions of copies of infamous lies are circulated. They are the only information millions of Soviet workers receive. English, American, Chinese, and New Zealand papers reproduce these lies by order. Advanced intellectuals who think they are anti-fascist will appear to believe them. One sees that a formidable enterprise of demoralization is functioning in the universe. Yeah, it's called Jews.
And that's what Bezmianov talked about, the demoralization process.
Yes, it is.
And he said it's mostly done, you know, in America by Americans to other Americans. It's something that countrymen that have been taken in by these Bolsheviks do to their other countrymen.
Well, exactly. But most of those by Americans that are doing it are Jews. I mean, that read the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. The names and the attitudes betray them immediately.
There aren't enough Jews, though, to maintain this regime of control, that it requires the active collaboration of millions of white people on a daily basis.
And they've done it. They've done it through the university system. They've enlisted millions of white people who are no better than Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Look at some of those talking heads on some of those CNN and Fox News and spouting the Zionist line daily. And thinking they're doing God a favor, supporting Zionism. Look at all those whores in the pulpits. Think they're doing God a favor, supporting his enemies.
Well, they worship Satan and call it Christianity.
Yes, they do. One sees that a formidable enterprise of demoralization is functioning in the universe. And I find it pitilessly just, the words of Trotsky, that the Stalinite Comintern propaganda is a syphilis of the workers' movement. What Maureen and Sergius wrote in 1936 only confirms what Pope Pius XI said in his encyclical Divini Redemptoris, issued in March 1937. One chapter of this famous document reads, quote, "There is another explanation for the rapid diffusion of communistic ideas. A propaganda truly diabolical that the world has perhaps never witnessed its like before. It is directed from one common center. It is shrewdly adapted to the various conditions of diverse peoples. It has at its vast disposal vast financial resources, innumerable organizations, international congresses, and countless trained workers." Sounds like Judaism. "It makes use of newspapers and pamphlets, cinema, theater, radio, and schools, and even universities. Little by little, it penetrates into the minds of all classes of the people. Another powerful factor is the suppression and silence on the part of a large section of the press of the world. We say suppression because it is impossible otherwise to explain how a press, usually so eager to exploit even the little daily incidents of life, has been able to remain silent for so long about the horrors perpetrated in Russia, in Mexico, and even in a great part of Spain, and it should have so little to say concerning a world organization as vast as Russian communism." I would call that world Judaism, not Russian communism. I mean, communism spread through the synagogues. That's how
absolutely
it spread so quickly and so effectively everywhere.
There's absolutely no such thing as Russian communism. There are Jewish communists that operate in Russia.
Right. Well, I guess the Pope was even afraid to say the J word, huh? Because this is a papal, paper that I'm reading that he's quoting from here. It's a papal encyclical. "The silence is due in part to short-sighted political policy and is favored by various occult forces, which for a long time have been working for the overthrow of the Christian social order. The sorry effects of this propaganda is before our eyes. Communism is striven, as its champions openly boast, to destroy Christian civilization and the Christian religion by banishing every remembrance of them from the hearts of men, especially of the young. In Spain, as far as possible, every church and monastery was destroyed and every vestige of the Christian religion eradicated. The theory has not confined itself to the indiscriminate slaughter of bishops and thousands of priests and religious of both sexes. It searches out above all those who have been devoting their lives to the working classes and the poor. The majority of victims have been laymen of all conditions and classes, with a hatred and a savage barbarity one would have not believed possible in our age. No man of good sense nor statesman conscious of his responsibility can fail to shudder at the thought that what is happening today in Spain may be repeated tomorrow in other civilized countries. For man, some restraint is necessary as an individual or in society. But tear the idea of God from the hearts of men, and they are urged by their passions to commit the most atrocious barbarities. Well, the Jews don't have the idea of God in their hearts in the first place.
Well, they hate God.
Yes, they do.
Most Jews are atheists. They don't even make a pretense of believing in any sort of God. And the ones that do claim to believe in God or whatever their concept of God is, they don't believe in an afterlife. So what's the point of having a divine creator of the universe if there's no afterlife? Did he just make us to live 60 years and then die and rot in the ground?
Well, the Jews believe, I mean, they're very open about it today, that they believe that they're their own Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
The last sentence of chapter 12 of Pawns in the Game. We will proceed to review the conditions in Spain to which Pope Pius XI tried to draw the attention of the Christian world early in 1937 and failed. It just amazes me that even the Pope could not identify the Jew.
Or he would not.
That's incredible.
All right, shall we jump into 13 or shall we save 13 for next week?
Well, it's we have 20 minutes. We could start it, be my guest.
Chapter 13, The Civil War in Spain. General Mola said, quote, following the election of the socialist government in Spain and the king's withdrawal from the country, there was an absolute avalanche of public officials who rushed to the Grand Orient lodges to request entry. What a bunch of opportunistic sellouts. They thought they could thus be free of the persecution which had been practiced by the majority of Masons in the government. Their purpose was to give evidence of their republicanism and to prevent the certainty of having their careers ruined. And of course, they didn't understand it's not a Masonic revolt, it's a Jewish revolt. And the Jews are just using the Masons as useful idiots.
Yes, they are. Just like they're using, that they used 40 million white people in the last election as useful idiots. 40 million white people had to vote in favor of that baboon in the White House to get him elected.
Immediately after the king had left, Franco told the military academy, of which he was then in charge, quote, the republic has been proclaimed in Spain. It is the duty of all at the present time to cooperate with their discipline and allegiance so that peace may reign and the nation be permitted to direct itself through the natural judicial channels. Hitherto at the academy, there has always been discipline and exact fulfillment of duty. Today, these qualities are even more necessary. The army needs serenely and with a united spirit to sacrifice every thought of ideology to the good of the nation and the tranquility of the fatherland, end quote. The wording of this proclamation shows Franco to be anything but a black Nazi, which communist propaganda would have the public believe him to be. And that's what we were taught in school, that Franco was just the Spanish equivalent of Hitler.
Well, right, but Franco is just like Hitler. He's the defender of traditional Christian Spain. Adolf Hitler was the defender of traditional Christian Germany.
And most people don't see that. They think that somehow Germany post-war was better than Germany after the Weimar Republic, but before the war under Hitler. They seem to think that a divided Germany, half under overt communism and half under parliamentarian democracy with speech control regulations, let's just call it de facto Jewish communism, was somehow better than a united Germany with all the Germans living happily and at peace. That's ultimately what the Americans accomplished. The American victory over Germany simply accomplished the enslavement of the German people.
Yes, it did.
But the secret
The final goal of that's the final goal of Judaism. I mean, either they'll do it through capitalism or they'll do it through Bolshevism. They don't care how they do it. They're going to do it.
Or they'll bring about anarchy, and in the ensuing chaos, they'll offer to restore order, and it'll just be some sort of Jewish totalitarian state.
Yes. Which is basically what the United States is now.
Mm-hmm. They offer to bring order out of chaos. And their ultimate goal is the enslavement or total destruction of the entire white race, every man, woman, and child. Yet they'll whine about some mythical 6 million while they're plotting to kill 700 million. But the secret powers were not willing to give the Republican government a chance to operate in an efficient and democratic way. Churchill wrote, quote, the communists helped set it up so they could knock it down again and create more political and economic chaos. Until they had the country and the people, in such a state that the leaders could advocate with reason that only a proletarian dictatorship could restore law and order and save the day, end quote. And Rahm Emanuel said, never let a good crisis go to waste. Isn't it the Jewish modus operandi throughout history? Wreck the nation and then offer to restore it.
Well, right, and that is the Hegelian dialectic. Yeah, you know, you have a thesis, and you have an antithesis, and you have a synthesis. The antithesis is the crisis that's created, and the synthesis is the final goal to achieve your thesis in the first place.
Look, they bring about the economic collapse of an entire nation, and they say that the answer is to let a Federal Reserve-style central bank under the Rothschilds come into power, and they'll take care of everything.
And basically, they agitated for the Federal Reserve for ever since basically the Civil War.
Well, they'd had it before but Andrew Jackson killed the Bank of the United States.
Well, yes, he did. So the Jewish money from Britain and France agitated consistently, manipulated our markets, caused the collapses of the 1800s until they could get a government weakened enough to agree to another central bank. And Woodrow Wilson was their man, the American Nero.
If we'd have had a man like Andrew Jackson in the opening decades of the 20th century, we wouldn't have been in World War I.
No, we wouldn't have. Or World War II.
And we wouldn't have a Federal Reserve Bank.
No, if we didn't enter World War I, the Kaiser would have won World War I.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he'd have been smart enough to throw the Jews out of Germany. I doubt it from what Hitler says, but the Kaiser, I'm sure, would have won World War I without American intervention.
Absolutely.
And we would have never had a World War II. And the map of Europe would have been different. We'd have probably never had an Adolf Hitler.
Andrew Jackson referred to the bankers as a den of vipers, and he said, by God, I will rout you out.
He was the last great American hero, was Andrew Jackson.
I'm guessing he understood the bankers were all Jews.
Absolutely. I'm sure he probably did. They didn't belong in the temple, that's for sure.
Absolutely, and yet today we have people inviting the moneylenders into the temple where Jesus fashioned a whip and chased them out.
And every single U.S. senator and every single U.S. president and every single U.S. vice president and every single U.S. congressman since 1913 has been a traitor. Every single one of them has been a traitor. Unless they put up a bill to abolish the Federal Reserve and throw the wolves out of the treasury, they're traitors. That's just the way it is.
Right.
They're all whores. They've all been whores for the Jew system ever since 1913. I mean, that's Revelation 17:17 fulfilled. It's scripture. But you still have to, even though Yahweh says it's inevitable, you still have to hate it.
Well, America is the great whore, and the entire world's been made drunk off of it.
Well, right. Israel is the whore, basically. And that's, you know, America's the leading Israel nation, not the Jews.
Having overthrown the monarchy in Spain, the next logical move was to attack the religion of the people. Secularism was introduced into the schools. A campaign was launched to destroy parental authority and that of the church. And we're seeing that here in this country. You can't even spank your children anymore. They get taken away and put in the home of some pedophilic rabbi.
Well, right. That is part of the Marxist plot against our race is to destroy the patriarchal family,
mm-hmm.
The bourgeois family, as they call it. And that's that, they use these newfangled child services agencies to do that. That's their vehicle for Marxism.
They talk
at
about
the family level.
The authoritarian personality with Adorno and all those other cultural Marxists out of the Frankfurt School, and how the abusive patriarchal father will ruin these children for life and they need to be taken away because he spanked them when they did something wrong.
Well, right, and they existed in order to help facilitate that.
Wreck the foundation of society by destroying or at least undermining the family structure.
Exactly, and that's the Frankfurt School is fulfilling and bringing to fruition the Communist Manifesto and the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion in this country. They were one vehicle which facilitated that. Yes, and
absolutely.
That they actually polluted three generations of academia.
And they're still polluting.
Yes, they are.
Having created thousands of anti-religious and anti-social young Bolsheviks, it was only necessary to await the opportunity to turn the masses loose against the forces of law and order in a well-planned revolt. On May 14, 1931, a meeting was held in the Ateneo Club in Madrid to discuss the new political program. Its 8 points were: one, creation of a Republican dictatorship, which that's a contradiction, isn't it? It's
yes.
Just the creation of a proletarian Jewish dictatorship. Two, immediate punishment of all responsible for illegal acts under the dictatorship. Three, disbanding the civil guard, the army, and the police, and the substitution of armed Republicans chosen from the laboring classes and Republican clubs.
Well, I
Four,
think they chose the language on purpose because, you know, the United States was the most powerful nation coming out of World War One, and they used that term because we're, I believe, probably because we're a republic, and republics are seen as positive forms of government, and just the use of the word alone is a powerful form of propaganda.
Well, it automatically conveys a sense of legitimacy.
Right.
Four, confiscation of property of religious orders. Five, nationalization of land. Six, suppression of all press agencies hostile to the Republican cause. Seven, utilization of technical schools and other buildings for the public good. Eight, postponement of the Cortez, that's the legislature, until this program had been carried out. Now, none of those are Republican platforms, though, are they?
Not one.
Straight out of
not that we would normally associate with a republic. Not that, you know, the two republics I'm most familiar with are the American Republic that was founded here in the 1770s and 1790s, really, and the Republic of Rome. And this doesn't sound like either of those.
No, this sounds like it's just a Republican name only.
That's what it is. It's Bolshevism and it's a wolf wearing sheep's clothing. That's what
it is. Like all the evangelicals who pay lip service to Jesus, but their hearts are far from him. These people are paying lip service to a republic, but they're all communists.
Yes.
Azana, an intellectual liberal, Prieto, a socialist, and Caballero, a communist, were three of the most prominent political leaders at this time. Azana, with his tongue in his cheek, publicly opposed such radical suggestions, although he secretly approved. When elected to power, he put the program into effect. In due course, the Cortes Constituyentes was elected under the excuse of, quote, law for the defense of the republic, quote. A ruthless dictatorship was set up. The only democratic feature about it was its name, the Republic of the Workers. I would probably call it the Republic of the Jews. A Moscow-trained revolutionary, Jimenez Azua, drafted the new constitution. Azana now concentrated his entire efforts on destruction of the churches and persecution of religious orders. In December
First thing the Bolsheviks do when they get in power.
In December 1932, he set up the League of Atheism. He financed its periodical, Sin Dios.
Like the French Revolution set the schematic for this.
Oh, absolutely. They destroyed every single church. They turned them all into, what was it, temples of reason?
Yes, they did.
But they didn't close the synagogues, did they?
I would think not. We'll find out when we read from Nesta Webster the next few weeks.
In December 1932, he set up the League of Atheism. He financed its periodical, Sin Dios, the Godless, out of public funds. So they'll scream and moan and rip their hair out if public funds are remotely used in any sort of religious context, even if it's just the cultural context of a cross or a Christmas tree or something like that. But they don't hesitate to use public funds for promoting atheism.
Right. And actually, Sin Dios literally means without God. Sin means without in Spanish.
All these moves were made in the name of democracy. Isn't that always the case?
Yes, it is.
Like the American Civil Liberties Union, they have us believe that they want us to become the freest, most democratic republic in the world, yet they've been instrumental in bringing us to where we are today, a secular, throwaway, worthless society.
Of slaves. We're entirely enslaved.
We're slaves to sin.
Well, we're slaves to the government. I mean, over half of the average, you know, the average working man, over half of his salary goes into real estate taxes, property taxes, school taxes, taxes on purchases. Never forget income taxes. Over half your money disappears to taxes.
You might as
You're
well just spend half of the year working on a government plantation.
Right, exactly. That's what it boils down to.
the leaders who told the people they were being liberated from the control of the religious orders and the clergy who, they said, were allied to feudalism and tyrannical monarchs. In Catalonia, the revolutionary activities which General Prim de Rivera had subdued broke out again. By January 1933, the London Morning Post correspondent reported, huge stocks of bombs, rifles, and ammunition are being found by the police all over Spain. An enormous amount of money is being spent to foster the revolutionary cause. Many of those arrested, though to all appearance not well paid, carried note cases full of banknotes. Now, I wonder where that money came from.
Well, it's too bad that they didn't tell us what kind of banknotes. Were they Spanish or were they British?
My guess, they were pounds sterling. They were maybe possibly American dollars, French francs. I doubt it was Spanish currency.
So we see that even though they won the democracy and the king left in 1931, in 1933 they're still fomenting and plotting a wider, more radical Bolshevik revolution.
Well, the king left, but that wasn't all they wanted. That was just one of the steps towards getting what they wanted. So they weren't satisfied with him simply leaving.
No, absolutely not. They want to take over the country completely and Bolshevize it and destroy the middle class, just like they did in Russia.
And just like they're doing here, but they're taking the slow route here.
Yes. Yes, because we keep giving in to them.
Well, Lenin said to use the hammer of taxation and the anvil of inflation, and you crush the bourgeois that way. And that's what they've done in this country. They've absolutely wiped out the middle class with taxation and inflation.
As long as we keep allowing them to push us in the direction where they want us to be, we won't have a war or a radical, violent revolution in this country. But as soon as we stand our ground, we're going to have to fight. And we're either going to have to fight or continue to be whores. I mean, it's going to come to that. And I believe that only Christ could get us out of this mess. And that's, you know, wholly Christian and wholly scriptural. However, it seems to me that as long as we keep allowing ourselves to be pushed in the direction they want us to go, we will be spared the horrors of Bolshevik Russia. But if we stood our ground, it would be some fight.
I say, though, if we tolerate evil, we should expect perpetual evil. And if we tolerate the lesser of two evils, we should expect perpetual evil.
Well, that's what we continually do, is tolerate evil. And that's our biggest sin. And that's why our people are punished.
They tolerate it in the name of libertarianism.
Yes, they do. And libertarianism is just another route to
communism.
To Talmudism, yes it is.
All right. Do you want to take over, or shall we end it there for the night?
No, we could end it here and pick it up here, you know, with Franco's reorganization of the Spanish army next week.
And I'd like to just point out, too, that everything Franco did was a reaction to what the communists did. The leftists, particularly academia in this nation, they seemed to put out the idea that Franco was just some bitter right-winger who didn't like being sidelined in Morocco, and he was a ruthless opportunist and a power-hungry maniac, and he decided to just gather his forces using the help of Hitler and Mussolini and seize power from a duly elected government that had come to power freely and fairly. That's absolutely not the case. He was reacting to communist excesses.
Absolutely. The entire Civil War was fought because of communist excesses. And we'll find that out.
We've started to show that, and we're going to show that more thoroughly, that what was happening in Spain is essentially, we might as well just call it Spain Number One, a collection of reports on Bolshevism in Spain.
Well, right. It was, you know, the Republicans were the Red Army, and Franco led the White Army, and in Spain, the White Army won. And basically, that's what it boils down to.
But, you know, most of these communist officials, I've been looking them up on your Wikipedia, they survived into the 60s and 70s, and they died in other countries. Some even just died in Spain. So there were no mass purges that we saw in the Soviet Union after the Bolsheviks came to power. No, of course not.
But that doesn't stop the Nazis never orchestrated the deaths of anybody.
The fact that these leftists are alive to decry Franco 20 years after the fact shows you he wasn't a bloodthirsty tyrant. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been alive to denounce him.
Exactly. There's no doubt. Just like we have so many Holocaust survivors, right?
It seems
if the Germans were really the beast that they were, we wouldn't have any Holocaust survivors. It's the whole thing is Jewish hypocrisy. It's all Jewish hypocrisy.
And as David Irving pointed out, it seems odd, biologically odd, but the number of Holocaust survivors is apparently increasing with each passing day.
Yes, it is. And in fact, I'm going to start claiming to be a Holocaust survivor.
How'd you survive?
Well, you know, I was alive during the 30 Years' War.
Oh.
When my family escaped the Rhineland and came here.
All right. Well, it's
no more fantastic than the stories of the Holocaust survivors. Maybe I could write a book.
You know how I survived? I remember to put my gas mask on when I went to clear out the chamber.
Okay.
All right,
then.
Next week, 8 p.m. Yahweh bless. Thank you.